and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Welcome back to My Alchemical Bromance. This is Eric Arneson, and our guest today is Scott Gosnell, entrepreneur, scientist, writer, wizard, and the translator of the collected works of Giordano Bruno. Say hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
I've been following your work for a little while. It's been really exciting to see all of Bruno's stuff come out, and you've been noticed by other people too. Like, you were on Rune Soup. You're on Gordon White's podcast, I think.
Yes.
Yep. And you even have a podcast of your own where you don't just interview weird occult people. You have like historians and scientists and thinkers of various sorts on, right? Like,
yeah, that was originally supposed to be the entrepreneur part of the bio there.
Oh.
But it was intended originally to be more people who were doing tech companies and that sort of thing. Initially devolved, or almost immediately devolved, into interesting people who I thought I would like to talk to. So science fiction writers and anthropologists and psychologists and, you know, Buddhist practitioners and just all kinds of different people. So,
well, I mean, that's cool. Did you get any interesting entrepreneurs on, like any interesting tech startups or anything like that?
Yeah, I've had a bunch of different people. I had, for example, the founder of Dagobah Chocolate.
They're from Southern Oregon, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frederick Schiller.
Yeah.
And he's interesting also from the occult side, in that he was inspired to or led to start the chocolate company or get really into chocolate after he had a vision of the goddess of chocolate.
There's a goddess of chocolate?
There is apparently a goddess of the chocolate plant.
Man, I feel like my entire life I've been neglecting her. Although I have certainly been eating a lot of chocolate.
The interesting thing about it is that although there are a lot of people who are into these what would be considered occult things, it's actually more common and more mundane than many people would think who do not look at the world that way.
Yeah, I think you're really right about that. And it's something that part of it is that like people who are into this sort of occult thing, you got a choice. You can either be honest and open about it, in which case a fairly large segment of the population is going to dismiss you as some sort of wacko or nut job. Or you can hide it, or you can move to a place like Portland where you don't have to hide it and people will take you seriously because you're not as crazy as the next guy.
Right. But also the thing is that like another person I interviewed was Mitch Horowitz. And one of his big things is sort of experimental religion in the history of America.
Yeah. Have you read Occult America, his book?
Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah.
But like the Quakers and the Shakers and the Mormons and the spiritualists and the transcendentalists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people who are sort of scientifically on the ball as William James in the late 19th century, mm-hmm. you know, who is doing, you know, serious psychological research, was also very interested in what's called new thought how ideas influence reality.
Right. And that stuff is really fascinating to me. I love how, I mean, people don't really realize that America has produced some very influential and major like religions and spiritual paths, you know, Mormonism probably being the most public, but like spiritualism was really big. The New Thought movement, I guess it's mostly American. But I mean, it's, and then even like you get stuff like Rudolf Steiner coming over and making like Waldorf schools and all of these, like, you know, there's so much occult stuff embedded in American history that we love to ignore.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that, it's possible to look at, just like the old saying that any sufficiently advanced science looks like magic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so does any sufficiently advanced magic looks like psychology, right?
Yeah.
Or it looks like science. So if you're doing it in the right way and it's not just, you know, an interpretive dance, you know, or something like that, then it becomes a way of looking at what the mind is doing in a kind of accurate way and isn't, you know, you have to anchor it in something real, but, you know, if you do that, then you end up with something very powerful and very useful.
Yeah, I think that there's a little bit of a danger there in getting, you know, sometimes when conflating magic and science, I think there's a danger of getting a little bit too wrapped up in like the materialistic view of the world. And, you know, hopefully we'll discuss a little bit about Cugliano and his views of like how the Renaissance mind worked and all that kind of stuff. But I think that we're still kind of stuck in the aftermath of kind of a combination of like the Protestant Reformation and like, you know, materialist heavy hitters like Descartes and Hobbes and the stuff that they tried to teach and how much we love them. Like, we love Descartes. Descartes is everywhere in our society, even though, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people don't really think about it, but like, is there any philosopher quoted more than he is? Like his "I think, therefore I am." You see it everywhere, all the time.
That's true. But
yeah,
in these interviews that I've done, particularly with the anthropologists, there are like three basic principles. And one of them is that, you know, you can trust that people in the past were no more stupid than they are in the present. Mm-hmm. Or as Lynn Kelly's friend put it, she said, you know, all of those old folks were practical. They were very practical. Otherwise, they would have died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So a lot of these technologies, which they couch in terms of religion or of magic. So she was speaking in particular of the Aboriginal song lines, mm-hmm. and how those are used as memory techniques to help guide people across the Australian continent. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things is that, you know, people back then were not stupid. They just didn't have, you know, they didn't have iPhones. They just didn't have, you know, electric light. Well, so they had to be even more
paper, right? Like they had to.
Right. Right. Record. So they had to be more clever in a way than we are. Mm-hmm. Right. Like if you screw up in modern society, right, there are ways to catch you.
Right.
If you screw up and you're out in the middle of the wilderness, right, and you eat the wrong plant or you get a little too close to the wrong snake, right, that's it for you.
Yeah.
So that was rule number one. Rule number two was you can generally trust people's observations, but not always their interpretations.
Oh, that is a good rule to keep in mind.
Yeah. So when people say, you know, St. Catherine or Hildegard von Bingen or someone is writing down their visions, mm-hmm. it's more likely that they actually had the vision, but you don't necessarily have to trust what their interpretation of that vision is.
Right.
Right. You don't have to trust, you know, how they think that that vision got into their head or how they came to have that vision.
Yeah.
And that applies regardless of, you know, time period or anything else. And then the third rule was that, you know, people in the past were just as fond of hoaxes and jokes and BS and will, you know, occasionally say things just for the fun of saying them, you know, or will write them in, you know, as an interpretation or as a fill-in for other material, which is actually real.
I feel like that one should be on a t-shirt and we should make everybody wear it.
Sure.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a Freemason, and one of the things that we have to deal with when looking at the history of Freemasonry is the huge explosion of hoaxes during the 19th century. And a lot of that stuff is still quoted by people who are like terrified of Masons today. Like a lot of the conspiracy theory stuff around Freemasonry comes out of stuff like the Taxile hoax and other stuff in the 19th century that it's just so tiring to see it, you know, like these people putting so much energy into something that was so definitely a hoax and so ridiculously hoaxy. Yeah, and then and that sort of thing must propagate through the centuries. I'm sure there are so many other places where we have to worry about that. And then the second one, the second point, remind me of that one again. I've had a long morning.
So that you can generally trust the observation, but not always the interpretation.
Right. The visions, like that one's really interesting too. Have you read? This book came out a while ago, and I don't think it ever made a big, very big splash. But John Michael Greer wrote a book called The UFO Phenomena, where he looks at like UFOs and compares them to the concept of like spiritual visions. And he's like, we know these people are having visions, but the way that they interpret them is based on the culture and the society that they exist in, right? So they're told that these are UFO visions, so they interpret them as UFO experiences, whereas, you know, because it's not okay to have visions now. Like, our culture doesn't accept right. it. There's not a space for it.
And right. And also, you know that there are people who see strange lights in the sky, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, that's a UFO. And literally it is, you know, as William Gibson said, you know, I believe that there are objects that sometimes fly and sometimes they're unidentified. But we don't know, like, that doesn't necessarily mean, like, that those are, you know, little green men in a tin can that came over from Mars.
Right.
Or whatever it is that people are thinking that week. Or, you know, it's not necessarily that there are grays. It's not necessarily, right, but they are experiencing these things, and they are sincere in having experienced them. But the interpretation that they or that you have about that experience may or may not be, you know, useful, or may not be the only way that you can look at that experience.
Yeah, I think that's right on the nose. All right, I want to talk a little bit about Bruno, because I want to hear, like, how did you find out about Giordano Bruno? What was your introduction to him?
So originally I found him through a series of books by John Crowley, mm-hmm. no relation to Alistair.
Right, the Egypt series, right?
The Egypt series. And so one part of the series takes place in kind of 60s, 70s, 80s America. One part of it is with a whole cast of characters in the late 1500s, early 1600s. Including Giordano Bruno and William Shakespeare and John Dee, mm-hmm. and several other people. And so in there, several characters use the art of memory, which is the technique of the memory palace, to do various things, some of which are memorizing things and some of which are, you know, manipulating reality in various ways. Mm-hmm. And so I read that, and you know, he sort of helpfully puts at the back little references. So, you know, that led myself and a lot of other people to Francis Yates' Art of Memory and Giordano Bruno and the Rosicrucian Enlightenment and all of the other Yates books. Uh-huh. And you've read all of those and you sort of say, wow, these are really cool. This is a really neat system. You know, I'd like to read the book Shadow on the Shadows of Ideas, which is Bruno's first memory book, which Yates mentioned several times within the course of her book. And you go and you look for it and you find out that it hasn't been translated in 400 years.
Right.
So, you know, I'm fairly stubborn. So, you know, I spent 5 years working toward a PhD before I finally got out.
Yeah.
And so I started looking for someone to translate this thing and you know, called up or emailed a bunch of grad students and classics professors and others who I thought might have an interest in doing it. And nobody, you know, they all said, oh, I don't really have time. I'm working on this other project. This is not my area of interest. You know, I don't really know Latin. I'm, you know, whatever it may be. You know, but you're a Latin teacher. And I'm like, well, I'm not a professional translator. And I said, okay, fine. And, you know, one of the rules is in another area of my life is, you know, if you ask enough people to volunteer and they don't, then, you know, sooner or later you ask for a volunteer and you have to be the volunteer.
Yeah.
And you have to do the thing that needs doing because, you know, someone needs to do it and you are someone. So you have to do it.
And you, so you broke up a little bit when you're talking about the Latin stuff. Had you had any Latin experience before?
I had had scientific Latin and a little bit of legal Latin and, you know, a little church choir Latin, in a Protestant church, but, you know, still, you get a good bit of it in that. And, but that was about it. And so I had to kind of teach myself on the fly how to learn Latin.
And I've heard that Bruno's Latin is kind of chunky and obtuse. Is it? Did you find it to be that way? Like, how was the? I mean, I don't know that. Have you looked at other Latin since then? So do you have like a sense of Bruno's style? Like, can you compare it to anything else?
Yeah. So he basically had three. Oh. One of them is, just it's very flowery. It's usually he does this in the introduction where he's trying to butter someone up. So he will, you know, he'll say, you know, this is you're the most glorious king in the world, or you know you've been such a help to me, Ambassador Mauvissiere, whoever it was who was his patron at the time, and you know how wonderful to see all, and he'll go on for a page, you know, on a single sentence. Or he will go on at length and say, you know, I'm a doctor, but of a new philosophy, a scholar, but of, you know, of strange things. And, you know, he'll go on about himself for a long way. So that's sort of mode one. And it's a bit difficult to directly transfer that into English. He also at times will just sort of say, you know, he'll have very terse sentences at the end of sections where he just says, oh, go look this up, or, you know, think about it.
Right.
And it's, you know, and again, you kind of have to, it takes a while to get comfortable enough to like unpack his language without doing damage to it. So hopefully I'm getting better at that as I go. You know, I'm on book five now, and I'm finally starting to get comfortable and say, okay, I can comfortably make these changes to what he's saying without messing with the actual meaning or without messing with his diction or something else. But for the rest of it, he's very clear, you know. And because it's Renaissance Latin, it tends to be a lot closer to Italian. Right. He's, you know, mentally translating it out of his native language of Italian. So it has an Italianate flavor. Other material from that age is also fairly good, especially if it's been, you know, if you get into the medieval stuff, you'll have a lot more of these little contractions and
idiosyncrasies.
Basically, orthographical idiosyncrasies that are sometimes hard to unpack.
Right.
But for scientific Latin, or rather the Latin of natural philosophy, which was going on at the time, it's fairly clear.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, De Ambrosio Idearum is such a, like, it's such a beautiful piece of philosophy. Like, he sort of walks you through all these steps, and he explains like his concept of images and like what is an image and how does it tie into, you know, his vision of like how the world works. And it's one of the things that's really that I find super curious about Bruno, and that I'm always looking for clues on, is like Yeats was really hooked on Bruno's concept of love, which I think carried over into John Crowley's books. But so Bruno had this concept of love being like a universal glue or a force that sort of tied everything together. Like, he probably would have named gravity love if he had been the one who discovered it and worked up the math for it, you know, if he had taken Newton's spot. And you get a little bit of it in De Umbris Idearum, where he talks about how, like, just looking at something isn't a true understanding. Like, you don't have a true understanding of a thing until the image is so deep in your soul or so deep in your understanding that you are basically in love with it. And so I think even in On the Infinite, like I confessed to you before we started recording that I haven't finished reading all of On the Infinite, but I get the impression that there's almost this thing in On the Infinite where he's like, yeah, the planets are circling the sun. The sun is at the center of everything. And the reason that they stick around is that the planets are in love with the sun and that they're not leaving.
Yes. So yeah, he definitely says that everything reduces to love. So mm-hmm. for example, in one sense, so there's one of his later works is on binding in general, mm-hmm. which, you know, we can talk about later, but essentially he posits these things called bonds which are connected to the idea of rays or other things that were going on in the sort of Neoplatonic and later system. So everything is connected by bonds mm-hmm. in the first place. And it's like all of these bonds, no matter what they are, reduce to bonds of love, right? So literally as though you feel tied to this person or connected to this person because you're in love with them. But if you hate someone, that's actually the same thing as love. Mm-hmm. So it has that same intensity. And really, you are in love with the person, but at the same time, that bond is repulsive. And, you know, and then so he's like, okay, so that's true of all the affections, mm-hmm. you know, all the emotions. But then it's also true for larger things such as planets, and this is why everything sticks together. And he says, so, you know, one of the issues is that he says everything has a soul in it, mm-hmm. right? And you have soul from pebbles to planets. And he says, so the weird thing is that you have a soul for the whole thing uh-huh. and you have a soul for each part of the thing. So like a human could have a soul for their big toe.
So that's interesting. Just this morning, I was reading something that Aaron Leach had written that was sort of talking about that same concept of souls being constituent. But I mean, that ties into sort of a unary or a monist view of creation as well. Like our souls aren't necessarily separate from the universal soul or from the one soul. We're just individual expressions or even like hallucinations of separation from it.
Right.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I think he might've been onto something. I don't know. I'm impressed by Bruno's mind. Like, he is a fascinating thinker. And I'm also like, so I just read the 30 Seals and the Seal of Seals. And mm-hmm. one of the things about that, like, first of all, it seems almost, like useless or I don't, useless isn't the right word, but it seems ridiculous that he went through and like cataloged all of these different types of spaces. Like, oh, this is how you can remember a list of things. Oh, this is how you can remember lists of things. And you know, your insight that they look like data structures in a computer was really interesting. But at the same time, I'm reading it and I'm like, are you just writing this to sell a book, Bruno? I mean, did this really need to be written down? This is a lot of this seems like really obvious stuff. Or like, for instance, the field, like his first seal, which is just a three-dimensional grid. And you're reading it and you're like, okay, so you keep things in a three-dimensional grid, but there's no structure that's usually associated with the art of memory to help you remember where all of this stuff goes now. I lost my train of thought there, but I guess I was just trying to say that after reading the 30 Seals and then going and reading Lynn Kelly's book on like non-literate memory spaces, mm-hmm. and realizing that there's a much more organic way to use the art of memory, which I'm sure Bruno realized, that it doesn't need to be like so structured and cataloged and broken down into like the nuts and bolts as much as stuff in the real world or the material world seems to need. Did you get any thought about that when you were reading about like his, or when you were translating his concepts of ideas, like how strict do you think he was in terms of the idea of the seals and keeping things in such rigid structures in his mind?
I don't think he was particularly structured. What he really liked was exuberance and variety.
Uh-huh.
So think about the field. Mm-hmm. Right? So the first of the 30 seals is called the field. It's essentially an empty space or basic space in which you can put anything else. So you go out and there's a total green field there, right? Nothing is there. Mm-hmm. And you just plonk your buildings or whatever else down in that field. So it's a place for you to construct smaller level places or lower level places.
Okay.
Right. And it's just a general organization thing. Same thing with the second one, which is the sky or the heavens, mm-hmm. where he's like, okay, so you essentially you're looking up at the sky, and instead of seeing constellations there or on top of the constellations that you see there, you can put additional visual images, mm-hmm. right? So instead of Orion, you put, you know, Madonna, mm-hmm. right, in that location. And that's your first image. And you, right, you go through the whole sequence of everything, mm-hmm. and build up this entire visual field at the top level where you can put the rest of the stuff. And some of those other, okay. right, some of those other seals are meant to be little second or third tier memory palaces. So, you know, like he has one that's like the physician's chambers and gardens.
Uh-huh.
And so you can actually imagine that, like, attached to this castle that you have, or in a particular location in the castle, you come upon this little, you know, physician's hut with the little herb garden out around it, right? And then you walk through that one,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you find the one that fits what you need.
Right, right.
Right, so when we think of this from like a neurological or psychological perspective, right, you want to have memory palaces where the structure corresponds in some way to the information that you are trying to memorize.
Okay, that makes sense. I feel like I've encountered that in my own use of memory palaces. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. One of the things that what do we call people who do memory stuff? Mnemotechnicians. but one of the things that you get like arguments about this where in like Ad Herennium it argues like you have to use a real building. And then like in Lynn Kelly's stuff, it's a physical space that memory is being used with, right? Like she talks about how her memory space, like she literally walks her dog, and her memory space is her neighborhood and the houses and trees and natural formations around it. And she talks about like the memory spaces of Neolithic structures, which, you know, she's like, and of course all of the rocks were different because you needed them to be different in order for them to be memory spaces. You know, they couldn't all be the same. But then Bruno is encouraging the use of like an entire imaginary world. Like his mind is populated with things that might be entirely fantastical, like buildings that may have never possibly existed in reality. And yet to him, he has created them in his mind with such, you know, fervor, or I guess love, you know, that they are just as effective as real spaces that have been memorized.
Right. So you have, like, I've done both. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're writing fiction, mm-hmm. right, you are literally building that imaginal world, mm-hmm. right, that you wander around in. So if you are J.R.R. Tolkien, right, every part of Middle Earth is alive for you and has all of these bits to it. Like, you know, there is a place in your head that is Gondor.
Yeah.
There is a place, right? There's a place that is Mordor, and you can go there and you can look at it. And sometimes you find things that you did not expect to find there.
Right.
If you're a writer. So that, you know, that's one extreme. On the other extreme, I have used memory palaces for final exams before, where I would literally go the day before to an exam room and I would place information that I needed to know in the various corners of the room and mm-hmm. on the clock and on the chalkboard and the desks and whatever I needed mm-hmm. so that it was right there and the entire room becomes a prop that helps you to remember it. Just like, you know, if you're writing down numbers for long division, right? It's easier to do that than to hold it all in your head if you've got 2 6-digit numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So it's easier just to take a pencil and paper and write it down. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, it's easier for you. It takes some of the cognitive load if you've got the prop right there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. That totally makes sense. Yeah. And
but it's less portable. So if you are going to be a traveling mnemonicist or memory artist or whatever, right? Or if you are an academic in the 16th century who keeps getting excommunicated and thrown out of places and is chased by the Inquisition, right? Then having a fully portable set of memory palaces makes a lot of sense, mm-hmm. right? Because you can't lose them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
right.
Yeah. It reminds me of the scene in the Egypt series where Bruno is in danger of getting kicked out of the Dominican monastery. And he's talking to his teacher. He's like, well, I ran out of memory palace space. Can I just create an imaginary tower? And his teacher's like, no, 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 no. That's a sin. But like, you know, even in there, he's like, but I can just create like as many towers as I need. I'm just going to do it. I'm not going to tell anybody. But except for I don't know, would you call it magical realism? I don't know enough about literary criticism to say that, but there's a sense that Bruno's memory, or the way Bruno uses his memory in that book, is affecting the world around him, or is like noticeable by the people around him, so he still gets kicked out.
Right. Yeah. So they figure out that he's up to stuff that is not within the bounds of what they want him to be doing. Mm-hmm. But the actual reason that he got kicked out was that he got caught with a bunch of forbidden books and he was going to be disciplined. Mm-hmm. And also, I think he just got sick of being stuck in a monastery.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even though it was like, you know, it was one of the sort of advanced academic institutions of the day, he wanted to get out and see some stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the third thing is that he was an extremely contentious person. Like, he was not easy to get along with mm-hmm. at any point in his life. And so somebody was going to denounce him sooner or later for something.
Oh yeah.
Right. And he'd already been disciplined, because one of the first things he did, once he started doing the Art of Memory, was he cleared out all of the religious images from his cell or his bedroom. Mm-hmm. Right. Which, if you do memory arts, you know, is so that he can put memory images up around his bed, right? But if you're, you know, a Catholic monk in the 16th century, you know, this looks like Protestantism to you.
Right.
And you're like, oh my gosh, we're going to have another Martin Luther here in the convent. What are we going to do about this? Mm-hmm. And you say, you know, Brother Giordano, or Brother Filippo, or whatever, you say, maybe you should, you know, put the Virgin Mary back up. And he says, you know, in no uncertain terms, screw you, I'll do what I want. Right. And so, right. And like, that has one outcome. Mm-hmm. If you're in a small community where people are, you know,
where they want
telling each other, right, there's nothing to do but gossip and read and teach and do that kind of stuff. So it's like any hothouse academic situation, and he was going to get busted sooner or later.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely, I mean, even the end of his life, he seemed like a very uncompromising fellow who was very certain of his convictions and really knew what he wanted to do, or really knew what he wanted to think. He didn't want anybody telling him what to do.
Right. Now, it was very serious, though, because he argued himself out of being pardoned. or yeah. well, essentially they were trying to work a deal at a certain point from what we can tell, that he would be confined back to that old convent or monastery in Naples, mm-hmm. and, you know, would be closely watched. But other than that, you know, they just wanted to make sure he wasn't out there rabble rousing and causing trouble and doing all this stuff. And he kept arguing with them. Right? And he's like, well, I'll apologize for all the religious stuff, but the philosophical stuff, I don't, you know, that's my own conscience and I can't do it.
Right.
And, you know, and finally, after 8 years of a trial and bickering with him over this stuff, they're like, all right, fine. Like, kill him off and, you know, stuck him on a fire.
So what is the fifth book that you're going to, that you're working on, that you're translating?
So the fifth book is going to have the essays on magic, mm-hmm. and also potentially the 30 statues, which is another one of his memory works.
That's a big one, isn't it?
It is a big one. So I don't know. I may have to break that off into its own book.
And how are you finding the Latin manuscripts for this, or the Latin versions of this?
They're fine. It's gotten a lot easier over the years. Uh-huh. You know, like I said, I'm a self-taught amateur, but eventually like things start to make sense. And,
I feel like at the minute you actually publish a book, you turn into a professional. You could be a self-taught professional now.
That's right. I'm a self-taught professional, an autodidact.
Yes. Right? I'm going to add that to your list of titles. Wizard,
okay.
comma, autodidact. Right there. It's written down on the back of my piece of paper here.
Very good. So now it's official.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you should add it to your add it to your Twitter account. Yeah. So, all right.
So it's a very interesting section of his work, mm-hmm. because it was only published posthumously.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What year did they finally get around to?
I don't know. I would have to look it up. Mm-hmm. But essentially, he had a lot of his books started out as lecture notes. Mm-hmm. Taken down by one or another of his students, or that he had taken down himself and then transformed into a work. Mm-hmm. And so this set of manuscripts, which were late writing, were written down by a guy named Hieronymus Bessler.
Uh-huh.
And he and his brother were, you know, natural philosophers. In Germany, they went on, the one brother wrote a very famous book about horticulture and flowers and botany, you know, and they were quite brilliant. But in his younger days, the one brother was a student of Bruno's before Bruno got into a fight with the local Lutheran pastor and got kicked out of town. So, you know, and that's right before he goes off to Venice to, you know, to teach this Venetian nobleman the arts of magic, or, you know, scare quotes around magic.
But that was a trap,
which might include
it? The
art of memory. It turns out it was a trap.
Yeah. And so that was the end. Well, I mean, he still had years. Living in a lovely hole, but
they caught him and put him through various trials and things.
Yeah.
But so these works are interesting because a lot of what he calls magic is really, again, natural philosophy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is, you can kind of see him both in the magical essays and also in the memory works, he's reaching toward something that would later be called psychology.
Yeah.
So obviously memory in general is like a psychological topic now. Mm-hmm. But also in 30 Seals, there's that the back section where he's talking about the Seal of Seals, mm-hmm. where he talks about some process called contraction.
Right.
Which is where your soul makes some sort of movement and you get a very weird result that is not explainable in normal terms. So he mentions cases of what we would call psychosocial blindness, mm-hmm. where, you know, some guy curses his son and the son goes blind and recovers his sight years later.
Uh-huh.
Right. Or, you know, or where Bruno's a little kid and he gets frightened by a snake and like starts swearing at it for like an hour. And the, you know, the servants come running and, you know, he's scared the servants and he's talking to the snake and he's, you know, there's a whole thing here.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, people who had supposedly learned languages that they had no way to know,
mm-hmm.
right? They were speaking in tongues or something. And he's like, all of these are examples of the contraction of the soul, which means something like withdrawal, but also could mean something like going from general to specific.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of meanings to that he puts on contraction. And there are a number of other Renaissance philosophers who had a lot else to say about this.
How much access did Bruno have to like Kabbalistic texts? Like in the 16th century, there would have been some stuff out there. But there's this concept that I guess like Isaac Luria talks about called Tsimtsum, which means contraction,
right.
Has to do with like an element of creation where God withdraws and contracts portions of himself to create as part of, you know, the Kabbalistic creation story. I'm wondering if a concept that Bruno might have had access to.
He definitely had access to some Kabbalistic knowledge, but it looks as though it was a little bit secondhand.
Mm-hmm.
So he certainly knows about the Sephirot.
Mm-hmm.
Because he mentions that the Kabbalists have, you know, 10 dignities of God or 10 attributes of God.
Right.
Right. And he compares those to Ramon Lull's attributes of God. And then he says, you know, I have 30. Because for him, I don't know exactly why he picked 30 or why 30 was the number that he was really entranced with. But wherever he's going for, like, here are a whole bunch of things, and this is kind of a complete unity, or, you know, like a complete universe of itself. He always does 30 of them. So in On the Shadows of Ideas, there are 30 intentions and 30 conjectures or other things. The wheels have 30 letters in them so that you can get in both the Roman alphabet and the Greek alphabet and the Hebrew alphabet.
Well, my impression of that.
But I don't know how much he had. I don't know how much Kabbalistic literature he had read,
uh-huh.
or if he had just talked to people.
I mean, I'm not sure how much thought he put into it, but my impression of the 30 letter alphabet he has is that he wanted to cover every like phoneme, every sound you could make with one symbol. Right. So if you look at
right.
the end, he's got phi, omega, theta, ayin, sheen, and zadi. Not in that particular order, but like he basically. Oh, and he has psi. So he's basically got like every sound that he's going to need to make in the language that he's memorizing. I always just figured that it was done that way. I mean, maybe it's just coincidence. I guess I don't know why 30, but yeah, he loves the number 30.
Right. And so, right. And again, 30 seals, 30 statues, mm-hmm. 30 of this, 30 of that. And it's always like in the magical essays, he says, you know, here are 30 things that you can use to bind with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some of them are like eyes or a ring
mm-hmm.
or right. And so he goes on through these things and some of them are like, you know, the abstraction of love. Right. And it's like it's not organized like. In modern days, we would be organizing things in what the McKinsey consulting guys call MISI, or, you know, mutually exclusive and comprehensively exhaustive, right? Categories of things. So uh-huh. you want to get like all the categories you can, but they should all be separate,
mm-hmm.
right? He sort of does more of a jumble sale approach. And right. And so he builds up these long lists of things, but they're not like, you know, this thing is over here and that thing is over there.
Mm-hmm.
There's like overlap. There are gaps. There are, you know, there's redundancy. There's all kinds of stuff.
If you could go back in time, would you have lunch with Giordano Bruno? Would you have a conversation with him?
Sure.
Do you think you would come away pissed off?
Yes, he almost certainly would.
Yeah. You know. Or no, you. Do you think you'd get pissed off?
I'm fairly level-headed, so yeah. Probably not.
I don't know. Bruno seemed to like. It seemed like his superpower was getting people pissed off. And memorizing it was. Things.
Yeah, so as I said in the intro to the first book, like, he's the only person I've ever heard of who got excommunicated from three different Christian sects.
Yeah.
So some of which I didn't even know excommunicated people.
They probably might have like invented excommunication just for Bruno. They're like, you know, we're going to need this probably again in the future.
That's right.
My Alchemical Bromance is sponsored by Miskatonic Books. Miskatonic Books is an online bookstore that focuses on rare, limited edition, and custom-made books of the highest quality. They specialize in books on the occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, and other topics of interest to you, our listeners. Check them out on the web at miskatonicbooks.com. You get interviewed about Bruno a ton. Like, every time people are really curious about all the Bruno stuff, and you're probably one of the only people really spending a lot of time with him, at least outside of academic circles, like in the realm that us ordinary mortals get to access.
Although I will tell you, I just heard that John Michael Greer is doing a translation of De Umbris.
I heard that too, primarily because he's doing it through Azoth Press, and Larry Roberts, the owner of Azoth Press, is a buddy of mine, and he had told me about it. And John Michael Greer actually is the person who introduced me to Bruno.
Oh.
Sort of, kind of in a roundabout way. Many, many, many years ago, he got me to read Francis Yates' book, and then he gave me a copy of his... He's got a really old article that in some defunct occult magazine that's about like introducing yourself to the art of memory and how to build a memory garden and all this stuff. So he kind of got me started with all this, and I'm looking forward to it. It should be pretty interesting. It'll be interesting to see the commonalities and differences between your translations for sure. That'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. That will be good.
Yeah. Yeah, so that'll be cool. I'd love to get more people paying attention to Bruno and more people like seeing what he was capable of. It saddens me how horribly most people try to memorize things. Like this whole rote memorization stuff, and you know that nobody seems to have any concept of how much they're actually capable of holding in their head. It makes me sad because when you start using it and you start using it for complicated stuff, you realize that there's no way to really successfully like conceptualize things until you hold it in your head and can like play with it and move it around and try to connect it with other ideas and other stuff. So hopefully we get more. Like now we've got memory competitions where people do art of memory stuff competitively, and I've been trying to get more Freemasons to use Art of Memory to memorize stuff, and I don't know how much that's working, but...
Yeah, I hear that there are some memory techniques that a number of Masons use to memorize things using linked images or using mm-hmm. linked concepts.
Yeah, well, so we have a...
Which, of course, you can't talk about because of the secret oaths.
I could talk about the concepts and some of the ideas, and I can talk about, like, some of the history of it. Like, we know that really early on, some of our earliest documents, you know, stuff that was actually written down about Freemasonry, included references to the Art of Memory. And in fact, there used to be sort of, like, officials who would go around and test Masons on the Art of Memory, and if they couldn't do it, they would get fined. So it was a core concept. And then in a lot of jurisdictions and a lot of Grand Lodges, as you move through the degrees and move towards being a Master Mason, you have to memorize these. Sometimes we refer to them as catechisms, but they're like these question and answer things that I didn't realize were set up as sort of linked images, but they're absolutely the same. They're the memory space that Giordano Bruno talks about in the 30 Seals. It's the chain. Like it's a linked list in your brain. I didn't even notice it before, but then I'm like, oh, look at that. So it was funny seeing some of those seals where I was like, oh, I've already learned this. I know this one.
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, that also is another tantalizing clue, because there's a sort of hypothesis that Bruno is connected to the Masons by way of, so he had,
yeah.
Bruno had a bunch of students who were called the Giordanisti.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and one of them,
Giordano's guys.
Yeah, and one of them was hanging out with some people in the royal court in Scotland,
right?
And knew the Shah, whatever Shah's name was, the master of the works, basically the guy who ran the original proto Masonic Grand Lodge in Scotland.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's another branch that went through the Rosicrucians.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So some of his students would have been about the right age
mm-hmm.
to have been involved in that first set of Rosicrucian things. Again, if you look at the Rosicrucian manifestos and writings,
mm-hmm.
there is a lot of image work.
There is.
Being done, right? And also, so if you go through the Masonic system, right, if the art of memory goes all the way back
mm-hmm.
to the Scottish Rite lodges, right, then you have something where you're like, well, who told them how to do that?
Well, I think we know right? for sure that the art of memory goes back to you know, semi-literate Europe, where
right. Well, we know that it goes back there, but also, like, it would be very interesting if that was a connection,
mm-hmm.
right? We know that these people were roaming around and were, they think, doing some kind of political activity
mm-hmm.
to reform or overthrow some of the rulers in Europe
mm-hmm.
and were, right, they were certainly very politically active underground, and we don't quite know what they were trying to do.
Right.
Right. But then, you know, you start to say, okay, this guy is connected to that guy, and he passed on not only the political activism and the, you know, secret society aspects of it, but also the art of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to go, wow, like, you know, these guys were really into that.
Yeah.
In a way that was highly specific. And as you say, if who knows how the seal got in there, whether someone read his books later or whether it was someone very early on who said, oh, wow, like, this is how you do it.
And I think sometimes it might have just been just an obvious way to put something together. You know, I mean, it might just be coincidence sometimes, too. Like, there's no actual
evidence. There are no coincidences. No coincidences at all. They were all in it together.
And 9/11 was an inside job.
That's right. But you're not a conspiracy site as well?
Once you are, well, I mean, I guess I would say that sometimes I listen to conspiracy theories, but I'm mostly a conspiracy skeptic. I have seen so much, and you know, primarily through like my study of like the Freemasonry and the Illuminati and the sort of stuff connected to it, and the amount of just like pure uneducated idiocy that goes into a lot of the conspiracy theories, you know, revolving around the Illuminati and such. It's so hard to take seriously sometimes. So I'll listen, but man, I'm going to really be skeptical. I probably won't argue about it though, because again, a lot of conspiracy theory people are not really open to having their minds changed. They've changed their mind once, and that's where it's going to stay.
That's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big proponent of the anti-conspiracy theory, theory of history, which is that, you know, there are more theories about conspiracy theories that cause people to act in a way than that there are actually conspiracies.
Mm-hmm. I like,
right? Because it's a more comforting belief mm-hmm. to think that there is someone in the back room somewhere who is in control of things.
Oh, yeah.
than it is to like realize, you know, most of these people, however powerful they are, you know, up to leaders of countries, are basically, you know, desperately trying to throw levers and to find something that they can actually make happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are frustratingly unable to get much done at all.
That's certainly right? What it seems like most of the time. I assume you've read the Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Anton Wilson.
Yeah.
And I love his idea about conspiracy theories in there, which is that everybody is equally idiotic and equally unable to get along, and every conspiracy is accidental and full of bumbling fools. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's, you know, I could see that. Seems like that when you really pay attention to, yeah. So I'm not a super big conspiracy theory. They're great entertainment. Let's put it that way.
That's right. Yeah. But you got to go back to those anthropological principles we were talking about earlier. Uh-huh. So like most things are not the result of a conspiracy, but also, you know, people do talk to each other.
Yeah.
Like, I don't believe that there's like a big elaborate thing, but like, you know, as they said, when Mike Pence appeared at a football game in Indiana for 5 minutes so that he could be offended, right? You can assume that he and Donald Trump talked about it beforehand, right? That's not a very, it's like, they're small conspiracies in the sense that somebody got on a private phone call, but they're not like conspiracies that last for 50 years to cover up the fact that aspirin is causing birth defects.
Yeah, totally.
Right, or whatever it may be.
So small conspiracies, right, I mean, which it is not. Yeah, I mean, like, that absolutely.
And they're really boring.
Yeah, they're not very exciting. Most of the time, conspiracies are not very exciting. And I would say that anytime they grow too big, they probably fail.
Yeah.
Or everybody agrees. You know, Freemasons like to joke about the New World Order. Like, you know, you guys are all scared that we are trying to bring in the New World Order, but you all already agreed to it during the American Revolution. Like, that was it. We got democracy.
That was our big conspiracy.
That it really was the big conspiracy. You know, we succeeded in some places and failed in some places, and it wasn't just Masons doing it. It was a lot of people who were kind of like, is the divine right of kings real, or did somebody make that up at some point? So, but let's talk about some of your other stuff. Like, let's talk about, okay, I have a question. And this is something that has really been bugging me. When you were talking to Gordon White, he asked you about Bruno and Neoplatonism, and you kind of like just outright was like, no, Bruno wasn't a Neoplatonist. And I was like, but what about, like, De Umbris Idearum is all, of, you know, he goes on and on about Plotinus, and he has these, like Neoplatonic visions of how images descend from the divine and, like, all of this stuff. Like, what is it that makes you discount Bruno's Neoplatonic things? Or did I misunderstand you? Or what's, can you explain a little bit?
I didn't think that I said he wasn't a Neoplatonist.
Oh.
I think Gordon might have said that.
Oh, well, then I'm super cool with Gordon being wrong.
And if I did, then I apologize, because he was very clearly a Neoplatonist.
Okay, yeah. And right? I think...
And he traces his Neoplatonism, you know, his biggest influences are Ficino on the one hand, mm-hmm. and... Nicholas de Cusa on the other. And so Nicholas de Cusa is a natural philosopher, churchman, Neoplatonist. If you look through the dialogues, on the infinite there, right, and you look at everybody who I have got a little tiny bio for, one of the words in almost every single bio in that is, you know, Neoplatonist. So they were, right. You know, bishop of so-and-so, Neoplatonist, right? Because that was the game in town,
mm-hmm.
right? That was it. So it was both hermetic, which I think Gordon felt that he was a Hermetic person, but not Neoplatonist.
Yeah.
But he is in fact both.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm pretty sure that it's nearly impossible to be a Hermetic person and not a Neoplatonist. I mean, there was so much like cross influence in that part of the world there that like Neoplatonism and Hermeticism are pretty closely intertwined. Like, there's a lot of mixing. Yeah,
they were all reading that. Basically, what was going on was that both Hermeticism and Neoplatonism were kind of the new learning of the day. Mm-hmm. So it was after years and years of kind of logic and Aristotle and right the sort of classical mm-hmm. Medieval curriculum, right? These come over into Latin and then into the vernacular, right? Ficino does the translating, mm-hmm. right? These things come online. He does them originally for Cosimo de' Medici, mm-hmm. and then they become common currency and everybody's reading them.
Right.
Right. So, like, a lot of these things which the magical people or the magically operant people of the Renaissance were interested in that are not really magic mm-hmm. are things like cryptography.
Right.
Are things like, right. So all of these things are really new knowledge that is somehow useful or powerful or just a different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so Neoplatonism was one of those, one of the pieces of the new technology of the day. Mm-hmm. So just like today, you know, people will go on at length and read all sorts of books about string theory or quantum mechanics or neuroscience, right? This was the string theory, quantum mechanics, neuroscience, right? Consciousness studies of the day.
Right.
Like, everybody was into it, right? Everybody was looking at it, and they were all trying to figure out how to apply it to the world around them.
Yeah.
What Bruno, like the one thing in which Bruno differs from previous Neoplatonists is that, you know, he's always about kind of breaking up the hierarchy and replacing it with a network. So if you think about the cosmological works, right, he says, okay, so the Earth is not the center of the universe anymore, right? It revolves around the sun. The other planets revolve around the sun. Okay, great.
But then he says,
but all of those stars that you see up there that aren't moving, those are other suns.
Right.
Right?
He says,
and if you were there, you would think, if you were on a planet revolving around one of them, you would think that that planet was the center of the universe. And you would be looking up at us and going, oh, what's that little star up there?
Yeah,
so
he really,
right. So you decenter the entire universe, right? And you take the Nicholas de Cusa thing, which is the, you know, God is a circle of infinite circumference whose center is everywhere mm-hmm. and whose periphery is nowhere.
Have you ever read Ben Franklin's Articles of Belief?
Yes.
Where he has
a long time
ago. I mean, he wrote it when he was super young.
Yeah.
And I don't think he...
Yeah, I read it when it first came out because I'm real old. So.
Yeah, you're like the same age I am.
well, I look good for my age.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I've got a gray beard, so. but his article, I love his articles of faith because he sort of talks about the same thing. He's like, he talks about the sun as being your local most deity, and that's the one that you should be worshiping. But then he also talks about like sort of an infinite universe populated by stars and planets and all this sort of stuff. And I'm certain that Benjamin Franklin at that young age never had access to Nicholas de Cusa or Bruno. So I have no idea. Did he just think that up on his own? I don't know. He's a enigmatic figure for sure, too. I mean, he's not that enigmatic. We have tons of stuff about him. We just don't know where his ideas came from all the time. All right, cool. I'm really glad that we cleared that up because I was super baffled during the interview. I was like, wait a minute. Bruno's not a Neoplatonist? That doesn't make any sense. But now it does make sense.
Yeah, so he just he isn't as big on the emanationist model. Mm-hmm. So where you've got, you know, the one up top, and then you gradually get less and less of the one as you go out to basic matter, right?
Yeah.
Which is in total darkness. So it's like, he's like, well, yeah, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that, you know, the one is present in everything. Mm-hmm. So just like we said, you know, you have a soul that's present in every part of your body, but each part also has its soul, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a soul that's present in the world, but each part of the world has its own soul. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's the same basic idea. Is like the soul isn't emanating from over there somewhere.
It's emanating.
The one isn't emanating from somewhere. It's like it is indwelling in everything.
So the soul of the world, the soul of creation, is emanating from the exact space that creation, it's immanence. The one is immanent.
Right.
And
right.
And our manifestation springs out of that immanence. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one for our listeners to think about. Ponder that on the tree of woe.
That's right. The, if you're really into like contemplating this sort of thing, one interesting book I was reading recently was David Kame Smith's Deep Principles of Kabbalistic Alchemy.
Oh man, he's an interesting thinker.
Yes, he is. And so yeah. I recommend it to your listeners, although if you start reading that book, you had better either be familiar with Kabbalah or alchemy or certain esoteric types of Tibetan Buddhism, mm-hmm. Namely Dzogchen.
Ooh.
And
Dzogchen's yeah. a tough one.
It is. So it's but you read it and you're like, okay, so this is really, it's a really neat book because it makes those connections and parallels explicit among those three mm-hmm. traditions.
I received
as well as the critical theory, but you know,
I received a Dzogchen transmission a few years ago, and a really good buddy of mine is really seriously dedicated to Dzogchen, and he's like, here are some books you should read, these you should buy, these books, get these books. And he like, I didn't follow through super well, but it's a fascinating system, and it's really like the stuff that it has in common with like Western ceremonial magic is pretty bizarre. I wasn't expecting that. So okay, now you gave me a list of like other things that you like to talk about, and one of them was pretty much about as vague as you could get. You said Jung, and I will confess that I am not super well versed in Jung's stuff, and I'm wondering, when you say Jung, are you really into like Jung like his psychology stuff, or do you like Jung and his alchemical Gnostic things? Are you, do you like keep a copy of the Red Book in the bathroom or something? Like what's your?
I do have a copy of the Red Book, but not in the bathroom. Oh. It's too big.
Right. Yeah.
Too big to read. you have to have a lectern.
Oh yeah.
But no, what I was generally thinking about was, as you said, I am frequently interviewed for Bruno.
Right.
And so I thought you might also like to talk about some of the areas which are Bruno adjacent.
Yeah.
So for example, as I, you know, we mentioned Dzogchen. Mm-hmm. So one of the areas that got me into was, I got into that because I was looking through a lot of material on Tibetan Buddhism because of the visualization exercises,
right,
connecting
right.
to the visualizations done in the Art of Memory, mm-hmm. And in the Ars Notoria, which was the predecessor technology used in the medieval times to supposedly cause spirits to teach you the seven liberal arts.
Right. Yes. I've read the Ars Notoria. It reminds me of, so I've also been looking through the PGM, the Greco Egyptian the papyri.
Yeah.
Which also has a little bit of like memory technology, memory magic, but a lot of it seems to mostly just be sort of like prayers or spells and not actually instruction on like how to sit down and create images or
right.
that sort of thing, which is interesting that they would leave out those vital details.
Yeah. So the technology of the Ars. Sorry, Dzogchen, but Ars Notoria. Uh-huh. Bruno in 30 Seals mentions one of his convent mates, mm-hmm. One of his fellow priests or monks, used the Ars Notoria, and he's like, and he got really good at all of these seven liberal arts, and then he bonked his head or something happened, and like all of that went away, and he's like, oh, like he didn't know anything. And he's like, my art is better. Like he's like, so basically he's repurposing this magical technology using stuff that we actually in the modern era would say this is psychologically like well-grounded. Mm-hmm. And as we were saying like earlier, like you'd better have that material end of it worked out, like the actual practical effect of the thing mm-hmm. worked out well, so that, you know, you're doing these supposedly magical technologies, but they have to work.
Right.
Right. And to work, they have to be in accord with how the world actually works. And the interpretation that, you know, earlier technologies such as the Ars Notoria gave were not necessarily accurate, or what they were attributing their success to was not accurate.
Right.
Like it may be very good for your memory to, you know, read books on grammar and then do your Ars Notoria prayer and look at this image and, mm-hmm. you know, thereby relax your mind and improve your retention rate.
That's a good point. Right? Yeah.
But they're attributing it to, you know, the spirit of Saturn or something.
And I mean, why? Why not? You know, they have different ways of describing stuff or different ways of approaching and visualizing those things.
I've been reading also visionary biographies of various people. So uh-huh. one of them was through one of the practitioners and reinventors of the Ars Notoria, which is a guy named John of Morigny. I think that's how it's pronounced, but he was a French monk in the 13th, 14th centuries.
How did you say his name?
John of Morigny, Morigny.
I wouldn't know how to say
I'm paid a small stipend by the French government not to speak any French. so, you know, there's yeah. that. But anyway, so so there's a new book out from Claire Fanger. Mm-hmm. Who called Rewriting Magic, where she goes through his visionary biography, and she's got another one out that is his rewriting of the Ars Notoria for converting it from what's essentially a sacrilegious set of prayers mm-hmm. to ones dedicated to the Virgin Mary. And so he tried mm-hmm. to purify it because when he first used it, he ended up having these incredible dreams in which, you know, he was being attacked by demons and God was scolding him and beating him up and doing all these things. Mm-hmm. So I was fascinated by the parallels between his visionary biography and one of the big writers on Dzogchen, Dujom Lingpa, mm-hmm. who was a 19th century Tibetan who received a number of termas revolving around Dzogchen things. And he had a very good attitude toward, he essentially supposedly never had a human teacher. All of his lessons and all of his training was delivered by spiritual beings who would come to him while he was in meditation.
So how did he invent Dzogchen, or how did he carry on?
No, it was there already, and the lineage is quite old.
Right.
Essentially he said, you know, the way he would treat it was he would say, you know, when I was five, I had a clear vision and someone calling themselves Guru Rinpoche came to me and said the following. And it's very good because he's like, well, you know, so-and-so showed up and they said, you know, I'm the Dakini queen of all space and time. And he's like, all right. You know, and it's like, doesn't sort of judge that. He's like, maybe you are and maybe you aren't.
Yeah.
But like, what do you have to say?
Yeah.
right? And so he has like, and so they collect like 50 of these things in this, uh-huh, in this thing. And apparently they had some rather fascinating things to say. And, you know, he also had some very good things that he wrote, and it was very helpful for him. So, and, but his big thing was the Dzogchen methods.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that I've been reading lately is Daniel Ingram's thing. I'm supposed to talk to him this weekend on essentially how he became an arhat.
What so, is an arhat?
An arhat is an enlightened being.
Is Daniel Ingram an enlightened being?
That's the big question, and apparently yes.
How can you tell?
I don't know how I can tell. I'm going to find out from Daniel Ingram how he can tell.
Do you think?
But essentially he, so in his book, he lays out the traditional Theravada paths, mm-hmm, toward enlightenment. And says, okay, here are all of the stages. Here are the jhanas, which are states of meditative absorption. And you go through them in a certain series.
Hmm.
Right? So there's a series you do if you're doing shamatha meditation, which is concentration-based. There's vipassana meditation, which is insight-based. Right? And there's another series for them. And what's interesting is that there are commonalities between the paths as traditionally explained and as he explains them,
mm-hmm,
right, and the meditative experiences that are found in mystical traditions across the globe.
Well, that is interesting.
At a very granular and experiential level. I mean, it's not just like, well, you know, people gradually become enlightened if they do these things. It's like, no, at this point, you know, at step 11, you will be here. You will, you know, like you will have the sensation that perhaps you can see through your eyelids and through the walls of your building, and this will last, and then the following will happen.
Is it okay for me to be skeptical of this claim that he's, I mean, I guess I'm going to have to wait. And is this going to be something that you're going to release on your podcast? Are you?
Yeah, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. Just, I mean, go ahead. If you go to integrateddaniel.info,
Integrated Daniel,
you can read the whole book there.
Uh-huh.
And you can make whatever judgments or interpretations of his claims that you want.
That sounds, I think I'm going to have to put that on my list of things to do after I finish reading On the Infinite. Oof. So can you tell our wonderful listeners, all 10 of them, where to find you on the internet?
Sure. You can go to my blog, which is bottlerocketscience.net.
Okay.
You can listen to my podcast, which is Startup Geometry.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me on Twitter, which is infinite_me.
Great. And that's awesome. It's been really nice having you on. I hope that we can bring you on maybe after you're done with the 30 statues and talk some more about interesting things you've discovered. And then in the meantime, you can find us, or me, I guess, My Alchemical Bromance, on the web at myalchemicalbromance.com and on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever you're listening to it right now. Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure. I'm super glad that we got to finally talk and nerd out about Bruno and dive into some of this cool stuff. And it sounds like you got some interesting stuff coming up.
Thanks, Eric. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.